It's been a week since Minneapolis cop Derek Chauvin was found guilty on all three counts in the killing of George Floyd. And across the country, most people were relieved.
It is restored faith in our justice system because justice has never been for us. So this verdict just means that it is possible that people are now seeing the injustice that has been given to those of people of color for so many years.
For many, the trial was difficult to watch.
Being a black man in America, or just being black in America right now, is exhausting, particularly considering the perpetual threats to our existence.
And it was very clear that for the black community, it was about more than one trial.
What happens to Derek Chauvin is not actually the bigger picture of the work that we are trying to do to transform the conditions that allow him to murder George Floyd in the first place. Our work continues regardless.
This is just the start of long-needed accountability for police misconduct.
I know that racism in America will never end. I'm hoping that racist oppression will end.
I'm Annette John Hall, host of WHYY's Real Black History, a year-long series that looks at the issues affecting the African-American community. Today, we examine how the Derek Chauvin verdict has fueled national police reform, and we look at what's next, because for many people, not much has changed. We'll talk to people who share old and new ideas about what real justice could look like for the black and brown community and how this moment may open the door to systemic changes in policing.
The George Floyd murder is so egregious that if there was ever a lightning rod that we could use for substantive change in regard to police brutality, this is that case.
We spoke with Philadelphia attorney Michael Cord, who often calls himself the angriest black man in America. He says that anger is well deserved. Even with what seemed like clear evidence of Chauvin's misconduct, a 10-minute videotape showing the killing, there was still uncertainty about a guilty verdict.
Remember the Philando Castile case back in 2016. There was a videotape in that case. Anton Rose in 2018 videotaped. Alton Sterling in 2016, I believe that was. And then Eric Garner in 2014. All this stuff is on video. And then I go all the way back to 1991 with Rodney King. There was a videotape there. So videotapes don't mean much when it comes to white cops murdering black people.
Civil rights attorney Timothy Welbeck wondered why a weary nation had to go through months of anguish to get a verdict for a murder that most of us saw.
The thing that I think strikes me most is that we have to go through a four-week trial for a murder we all witnessed on camera. And I understand that Derek Chauvin is entitled to due process. I understand how the system works, but it's horrific to have to relive these events each day, and the prosecution functionally have to beg and plead for some type of accountability for this heinous killing of George Floyd that the world has now witnessed.
The list of unarmed black people killed by police is long and painful, and systemic racism runs so deep. But there was a feeling that this trial for the killing of George Floyd addressed police brutality head on. A Minneapolis jury, diverse in race, gender, and age, broke a troubling pattern of police acquittals with three words, guilty, 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 on all counts.
He's supposed to be convicted. There probably will never be a more graphic example of police murdering somebody. Now, of course, there's going to be shootings and that kind of thing, but I don't think there's ever going to be a situation where a white cop is going to strangle a black man to death for 10 minutes with dozens of people hanging around. And the fact that you and I and other intelligent people are not sure if he's going to be convicted. Think about that for a second. You talk about being caught red-handed. And we're still not sure if he's going to be convicted. That speaks volumes, the fact that we're not sure about it.
Former Philadelphia Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey expressed what many were feeling. But coming from someone who represented law enforcement, it meant something more.
Listen, if it is a conviction, you'll hear a collective sigh of relief from police chiefs and sheriffs across the country. There's going to be a sigh of relief if this is a conviction, no question about it.
History teaches that police hardly ever suffer punishment for the brutal treatment of the citizens they vowed to serve and protect, unless those citizens are white.
The idea that police officers abuse their authority and routinely harass and accost people, particularly Black people within their communities, is not a new critique. We've had that critique for centuries.
The critique has been around since the beginning of policing. In the early 18th century, the roots of policing began in the slaveholding South as an early form of organized enforcement designed to control the movements and behaviors of enslaved Black people.
Many people bristle at this idea, but the institution of policing began in America with slave patrols in the early 1700s. That is how we began to create this institution. And as it became more formalized, law enforcement began to take on additional roles rather than trying to track escaped enslaved people. But the racial dynamics of that institution have never gone away. So what we see now is when police officers abuse their authority and brutalize people disproportionately, the people that they brutalize are Black people.
Chauvin was found guilty, but it may have been different if not for the courageous actions of Darnella Frazier, a 16-year-old bystander who turned on her cell phone camera to capture a murder taking place right in front of her eyes. Still, the verdict didn't grant any justice for George Floyd, and there won't be any justice at all until a nation shows it values Black lives by dismantling systems that promote and condone racist actions. But we're not there yet. In a Minneapolis suburb, just a few miles from where Chauvin's trial was taking place, Duante Wright, a 20-year-old unarmed Black man, died at the hands of police.
Duante Wright! Save his name!
In Philadelphia, protesters took to the streets in solidarity.
That right there shows the very contradiction that we're fighting against. Even in the context of a trial around a police murder, the same police system and the same police force can't stop itself from killing more Black people.
Crystal Strong is an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania and a core organizer with the Black Philly Radical Collective and Black Lives Matter Philly.
You know, I am struck by the weight of that, the emotional and psychological impact of that.
If the Wright shooting wasn't traumatic enough, just moments before the Chauvin verdict was announced, police in Columbus, Ohio, shot and killed another Black youth, 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant. That investigation is ongoing.
That's the reminder of how much work there is to be done.
Yane Indigo is an organizer for Black Lives Matter Philly and helped launch the Black Philly Radical Collective. She says the joy that people wanted so badly from Chauvin's guilty verdict was undermined by more shootings.
At the end of the day, you know, our good brother George Floyd is still not with us. He was still taken from his family and from his community, and nothing will bring him back. And I'll tell you, I'll go without a single dollar or dime rather than lose my mother or my daughter or my sister to anything like that. There's no justice that brings a person back.
When you look at the history of white violence against Black people, you notice that one, it happens on a continuum, and two, the more public the outrage, the more likely the nation will act. In 1955, when people tuned in to reports of Emmett Till, the 14-year-old Chicago teen who was killed by white racists in Mississippi, white people, along with everybody else, were horrified to see the body of Till, savagely beaten and tortured, laid out in an open casket for the world to see.
not only did it remind everyone that what we had heard anecdotally was true, but that the brutality was potentially worse than people even imagined. Mamie Till's courageous decision to allow the world to see Emmett Till's body in that open casket funeral helped to catalyze a moment and energize a movement. And we saw this more directed action invigorated in part because people realized what was at stake in the moment.
If there's any solace to be had in the murder of George Floyd, it's that his death strengthened the resolve of those who fight for justice. Villanova Law Professor Terry Ravenel is hopeful.
Do I think that George Floyd's death can be the catalyst of change? I have never been so hopeful from such a tragic situation in my entire life. And the hope doesn't simply come from sort of the general outrage. It actually comes from the fact that we have seen true widespread action and support that has grown out of this outrage. It's one thing to be outraged. It's another thing to actually do something about it.
Ravenel says something else may help move the needle.
We saw millions of people take to the streets during a pandemic this summer. And what I think made this so much different than so many other protests is the Black Lives Matter protests, they were no longer just consisting of Black and brown people. And it's unfortunate that we frankly need white people to care in order to sort of get change. But what history has suggested is that when non-Blacks start caring about Black people's rights and Black people's lives, that's when we actually really start to see change happening.
Civil rights legislation was already snaking its way through Congress in 1963 when the Ku Klux Klan bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, killing four Black girls, Denise McNair, Addie Mae Collins, Cynthia Wesley, and Carol Robertson. The tragedy evoked national outrage and pushed Congress to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Unfortunately, legislation is seldom prophylactic, and it's almost always reactionary. When we think about some of our earliest forms of civil rights legislation, it was always in reaction to the way that Black people were being treated. So much of the legislation that came out of the Reconstruction era was about trying to react to the way that Blacks were being treated. And Blacks were being treated horribly.
Reformers agree that the Chauvin verdict represents a step forward, but the nation needs to change the way it thinks about police practices, especially when it comes to interactions with Black people. What could that look like? When we return, the promise and limitations of the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. Welcome back to Real Black History. I'm Annette John Hall. The George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, now waiting for a vote in the Senate, aims to ban certain police tactics like chokeholds and no-knock warrants. There's also language in the bill for improving police training and investing in local programs that come up with meaningful changes. Terry Ravenel, a law professor at Villanova, doesn't think it goes far enough. The bill will abolish qualified immunity, the idea that cops can violate your constitutional rights and not have to pay for it from their own pockets. While abolishing qualified immunity sounds fair, Ravenel says the implementation of it is tricky because most cops can't afford to pay.
The Derek Chauvin example is a perfect example of that. He hasn't paid a dime for killing George Floyd. The municipality for whom he works has paid over $12 million for him killing George Floyd. And what's really important to recognize about that is municipalities are artificial beings. And so when we say the municipality pays, that means that taxpayers pay. It's not the municipality paying. It is every taxpayer who pays.
And when taxpayers disproportionately bail out police for their misconduct, other essentials suffer.
When we think about the idea that taxpayers are paying for police misconduct, what we have to understand from a simple budgetary standpoint is that that money is coming from somewhere. When we don't have money for air conditioners in schools, when we don't have money for teacher pay raises, for parks, to help unhoused people, to help people suffering from mental health crises, where did that money go? Some of this money went to fund settlements for police officials who not only do we pay for their salaries, but we then pay when they have violated our rights.
What communities of color say they want is an overhaul of policing that will keep Black and brown people safe. And one of the changes reverberating throughout the nation is the idea of defunding the police.
That's probably one of the worst coined phrases that I've heard in a long time. But what it supports is rethinking how we fund our municipalities and how we fund services.
Funding police usually takes up a majority of a municipality's budget. Supporters of defunding want to see that money go to programs that need it.
Part of what sometimes people get confused about is that the call for defunding is to bring attention to the fact that policing and prison accumulates so much of our resources, our public resources, that should be redirected to back to communities, because those are the things that will actually keep us safe.
Strong and other organizers refer to themselves as abolitionists. Abolitionists in the style of Frederick Douglass, who worked to end slavery in the 19th century? They would say yes, because liberating communities of color from systems of oppression is the mission of these 21st century freedom fighters.
We've seen a few different sort of iterations and transformations of the conversation around abolition. Some of it has involved community control of police. Some of it has involved Black people's affirmation of their right to self-defense against police. Some of it has involved calling for decarceration, calling for the freedom of political prisoners. So free them all is an abolitionist kind of stance to have.
Right now, the focus is on police reform. But Michael Cord says some reforms, like additional training, just give lip service to solving the problems.
Cops know it's not right to beat people down because they're Black. They already know that. So the training does nothing. The training is just an attempt to make the public think that we're doing something.
Court says local departments should take a page from the city of Berkeley, California, where the mayor has limited police from dealing with low-level offenses. Instead, refocusing their efforts on driving violations that threaten traffic safety.
We have to make laws that restrict cops from traffic violations unless they have reason to believe that somebody's life is in danger. If the person doesn't have the right stickers, or if the person got something hanging from the window, just take a photograph of that license plate and just do like they do at the toll booth. Just send them a notice later. Because every time, or most of the time, when there's an encounter between the police and a young Black man, it always turns out bad.
While many Black people don't think police departments should be abolished, Crystal Strong says overhauling police departments has not worked.
Because of all of the police murders that we are watching on our phones, on our laptops, because of the rising social awareness of how frequent police violence is, and police murder in particular, and the way that police are clearly incapable of reforming themselves. I think that is showing people that we need more than reform. In fact, we need the end of police, and that abolition is, you know, part of that is perhaps defunding as part of a process of abolition. And so we are collectively investing resources in the source of the problem as opposed to the solution. And so that is where I understand the abolitionist call really crystallizing in this moment, a more collective recognition that policing can't be both problem and solution.
These haven't been easy times for Americans, especially Americans of color. A fear I've had for years is my son leaving home in the morning and not returning at night because an encounter with police turned deadly.
I know that racism in America will never end. I'm hoping that racist oppression will end. I don't care if my neighbor calls me the N-word in his house. I don't care if my neighbor calls me the N-word talking to his friend at work. You can be racist all day long. I actually don't care if my neighbor burns a cross on his lawn, I don't care about you being racist. The line is crossed when you inflict your racism upon me.
Still, this moment does feel different. It feels like there's a shared righteous anger among Black and white Americans that can fuel the systemic change needed to keep Black people safe. Last week, Attorney General Merrick Garland announced that the Justice Department will examine whether Minneapolis police use excessive force against communities of color. And many states are already testing their police reforms. Those lawmakers creating policy will be held accountable by those protesting in the streets. And that's where hope lives.
There's a lot of hurt, harm, and death that's happening in our communities that surrounds this. And that's the part that creates a bit of a struggle. But there's a requirement for us, for our own health, for our own continued motivation. It is required that we still embody and accept every piece around this moment that can give us joy and can keep us going. If I'm on the streets with the people and we got their music and we stomping our feet and we are dancing, like, I'm in that moment because that moment of joy is necessary and required. And for us to be able to come together and have anything for celebration, it's a necessary thing. But then I'm very focused on liberation for all. So the work keeps going on until we all are free.
Real Black History was produced by Jeanette Woods. We had editing help from Sandra Clark, Melanie Roy, and Katie Colinari. Our engineer was Mike Villers. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. I'm Annette John Hall. Thanks for listening.